Great. Why don't we get started? Good afternoon, everybody, or I guess still morning. My name is Patrick Coyne. I'm responsible for the marketing efforts at Alpine Funds, and we're excited to be in front of you today to talk about two of the closed-end fund strategies we manage at Alpine Funds, our Alpine Global Dynamic Dividend Fund and our Alpine Total Dynamic Dividend Fund. We manage a third closed-end fund, the Alpine Global Premier Properties Fund. After today's presentation, if you have any questions or you're looking for marketing material, please stop by our table. We'll be more than happy to provide you that information and answer any of your questions. So we'll be, again, highlighting two of the funds. We have our portfolio management team here today. The Global Dynamic Dividend Fund, ticker symbol AGD, and the Alpine Total Dynamic Dividend Fund, ticker symbol AOD. So why do we feel now is a good time to get in front of you to talk about these funds? Well, first off, we believe investors are still looking for income, and they're looking for income outside of the traditional fixed income strategies. This is a pure equity strategy. And they want income without sacrificing total return. When you look at the returns of our funds over the last 5 years, the funds have been together for the last 10 years, they're very compelling total return products. And lastly, clients ideally want to keep it simple, one product solution to deliver all those product problems. So we believe global equity income investing delivers all of those, income, total return investing, as well as global active management. So the really high level, what are some of the statistics on the fund as of March 31st? You'll see that the fund's currently, AGD has $135 million in assets. The fund is currently selling at a discount of about 8% and yielding also a little over 8%. And there's very, very little leverage in these portfolios. And we'll get into more detail about leverage in the funds. AOD is a slightly larger fund, is a little over $1 billion. It yields slightly higher, a little over 8.5%. Leverage is very low. And you'll also see that it's selling at a discount of 12%. So both funds are selling at a slight discount, improved pretty significantly, but still at a discount today. So if you're familiar with these funds, they've evolved quite a bit. In particular, there's some big changes that happened to the funds about 4.5 years ago. The first we want to highlight is the portfolio management change. Josh Dietz and Brian Hennessy became the co-portfolio managers of that fund in December of 2012. They are the senior members of the 11-member team that's at their disposal to help them manage the fund, broken down by analysts as well as senior portfolio managers. Their investment process is a very bottom-up active process, and we'll get into more detail about that. Evaluation tilt, but a portfolio that's looking to focus exclusively in dividend-paying stocks, over 90% of the portfolio. Risk management is very, very important in the portfolio. No positions over 2% of the portfolio. We'll get into more detail about our dividend strategy. Josh will get into that with you to show how we're able to deliver that dividend yield to you. And lastly, the dividend management of the fund has been very, very important. That's what we learned 5 years ago. We did cut the dividend in 2013, and we slightly raised it in 2014 and in 2015, and we've been able to maintain that dividend since then. So our speakers today, Joshua Dietz to my left, immediate left, and then Brian Hennessy. Josh joined the firm about 10 years ago. He came to us from Bear Stearns. He's responsible for both these closed-end funds and has experience managing our Alpine Global Infrastructure Fund. You may have also noticed Josh has been on CNBC and other financial networks over the past 3 to 4 years. Brian Hennessy has been with the firm since 2008, so about 9 years. He came to us from a couple of hedge funds, and he also worked at Putnam Funds before joining Alpine as an analyst and then ultimately as a portfolio manager. So with that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Josh.
Great. Thank you, Patrick, and thank you all for being here. As Patrick mentioned, Brian and I started managing these funds in December of 2012. And what this slide is showing that on a yearly basis, our fund has either matched or outperformed our benchmark, the MSCI All Country World Index, almost every year. And we've done that while our yield has been 7 to 8% versus an index which has a yield of 2 to 3%. And you look at the next slide, that's a slide for AOD. It's a similar story to AGD. Again, the fund on an NAV basis has yielded 7 to 8% over the past several years, while the MSCI All Country World Index has averaged 2 to 3%. The next slide shows our investment process. We start with a top-down, bottom-up approach, and we look at regions and sectors in the MSCI All-Country World Index. And we're not looking to make major macro bets on any of that, nor are we trying to hug the index. We're not benchmark huggers, as there's over 2,000 names in that index. We truly believe our competitive advantage in managing these funds is our stock selection. We do that through an 11-member team process. Alpine's a small firm, which allows for constant dialogue and communication between all the members on the teams and other portfolio managers within the firm. So we meet with our analysts on a daily basis to discuss our portfolio and the companies that we own in the portfolio. And we talk about if there's any earnings announcements, any major news about the companies that we own, or news about the industry or competitor companies that we might look at. So from there, we also mention names that we might want to own in the fund, and that begins our process of researching a company. We actually have a parallel process where Brian and I will start researching the company, and our analysts will as well. This allows us both to learn about the company and ask questions. And we do our research by reading the annual reports and quarterly reports, as well as reviewing recent earnings transcripts and reading the street research. We feel that's very important to understand the street's expectations for that company. In addition, we generally try to speak to the management of the company. If we can't do it in person, then we'll have a conference call with the management. It allows for an extremely dynamic process. And we're looking at our portfolio as a daily basis. Brian and I also take a step back, and we look at the portfolio to understand where our overweights and underweights are within the fund, and make sure we understand those risks. In addition, we have to present the fund to the office of the CIO, and it makes us defend our overweights, underweights, as well as the positions in the fund. Brian and I also look at attribution reports on a weekly basis to make sure we're not missing any major trends in the market that we don't see on a daily basis by looking at it too micro. It is an extremely dynamic and fluid process. And now let Brian talk about some of the risk factors.
Thanks, Josh. One of the pillars of our strategy and something we really pride ourselves on is a rigorous risk management process. We go through performance attribution, as Josh mentioned, regularly to identify trend changes early and adjust sector and regional weightings based on our convictions. We have regular and ad hoc meetings with our research team to go over new ideas and review holdings to make sure we are sticking to our core disciplines. We also monitor price movements of all the stocks within our portfolios, and when the risk-reward of any individual stock falls below our threshold, our own risk tolerance, we trim or sell the position. Another thing to keep in mind is we have a very diversified portfolio, not just across sectors, but across regions as well. We don't let any one position get so large that it changes the risk profile of our funds. We also make sure that we can exit any one of our positions within days. Let me pass it back to Josh. He's going to go into some more detail on how we capture dividends.
So as we mentioned earlier, we have a much higher yield than the index, and we generate it using a very innovative approach. We have three key strategies to our dividend process. The first being our core portfolio. Those are the stocks that I was talking about during our investment process. These are the names that we like, we love, we hold long term. It makes up between 80 and 100% of our portfolio and generates a yield of about 3%. The next part of the strategy are known dividend events. We've done a lot of quantitative research on when the best time to buy and sell a dividend before and after the X date. In addition, I used to work at Bear Stearns, and I traded international equities there, so I try to use some of my trading knowledge when buying and selling these stocks. And there's a combination of ways we do dividend capture. Sometimes it's a very short-term hold for a couple of days to a couple of weeks. Other times it's a 61-day hold, and the 61-day hold is a special reason for that. It's because it allows for the dividend to be qualified, and thus you have a lower tax rate. And sometimes of the core names that we know and we own, we'll increase our position right before the X date within a few days or a few weeks and then sell our original position after the X date. This allows us to capture twice the dividend and also have a 61-day hold on twice as much dividend with increasing the risk only a small amount. And the last part of the strategy is the special dividends. These are either companies announce a special dividend, and we try to anticipate those special dividends by speaking with the companies and examining and reviewing the balance sheets and understanding which companies have a history of paying special dividends at certain levels, and also reviewing companies after they announce a special dividends to see if we want to own those companies. And again, it could be for a few days or a few weeks or 61 days or longer, depending on our risk tolerance and how much we like that company. Now back to Brian.
We'd like to show you some statistics that we're getting from Morningstar, highlighting some of our risk metrics. We're pretty proud of these numbers because they highlight what we're trying to do. We want to be conservative, but at the same time, to generate good risk-adjusted return in alpha. We're especially focused on the up-capture and down-capture ratio. What that means is we want to capture as much of the upside and as little of the downside of our investable universe in both bull markets and bear markets. These numbers suggest what we're trying to, that we're actually achieving that goal. Our two closed-end dividend funds, AGD and AOD, are three-star rated overall by Morningstar. But something to keep in mind is that Josh and I took over these funds about 4.5 years ago at the end of 2012. If you look at the three-year and the five-year ratings and numbers, we think it's a better representation of what we've been doing. And these funds are generally four-star rated in those time periods. We hope to move that overall three-star rating up to four stars or in five stars in the foreseeable future, and we think we're on track to do that. So let's take a look under the hood of these funds. Regionally, our biggest overweight is in Western Europe, where as of March 31st, we were about 12-13% overweight at, say, 34% versus 22% for the benchmark. We're finding some very interesting risk-reward opportunities in Europe. We think Chris's presentation preceding ours was a great introduction to Europe. We totally agree. We'll get into that in a little bit more detail. We're also overweight the U.S. At about 58% versus 52% for the benchmark. One key driver there is the potential tax reform, increased infrastructure spending, and the overall business-friendly stance of the Trump administration. In terms of sectors, we're overweight banks because we think deregulation and rising interest rates in the U.S. will be tailwinds for that sector. And just as another example, we're underweight consumer staples because we think there's going to be a rotation into cyclicals that is a headwind for that sector. So one thing I want to add is if you look at the top 10 holdings, there's a lot of overlap between these two funds. We are diversified, though. We have the top 10 holdings make up about 14%, roughly, of the total overall exposure of these funds. That's it. Let me just pass it back to Josh. He's going to go over some of the more nuances, the differences between these funds.
So some of the differences are AGD, over 50% of the dividends have to be qualified according to the prospectus. Now, AOD does not have that in its prospectus, but a good chunk of its dividends are also qualified. AGD is allowed to be 10% levered. AOD could go up to 33% levered. Typically, we're between 0 and 4% levered in these funds. AGD, again, by prospectus, has to be 40% outside of the U.S. AGD has to be 40% out of the U.S. AOD does not have in its prospectus anything, but typically we're over 35% outside the U.S. in AOD. And AGD has a slight tilt towards smaller cap stocks. On the next page, again, Chris gave the whole presentation 20 minutes. It was fantastic for us. That was not planned at all, but it really shows the case for Western Europe. We have a couple of slides to show that as well. We see, even though, as Chris mentioned, the earnings in Western Europe are starting to increase, there's now a large gap between the P ratios between the United States and Western Europe, and it's at its widest point with the exception of the financial crisis for the past 10 years. The next slide just further shows the price-to-book ratios where at its widest margin between the U.S. and Europe over the past 10 years as well. So, and just one more point. So although we like Western Europe, we really, in order to invest there, we have to find companies that we feel are inexpensive, inexpensive relative to where it normally trades, inexpensive to its peers globally. So we're not just saying we want to invest in Western Europe. It really comes down to finding companies that we feel have good earnings growth and are priced relatively inexpensively. Brian.
So we've mentioned that we're optimistic about Europe. Let me elaborate a little bit more. If you look at the purchasing manager indices, or PMIs, across the globe, which we think are good leading indicators for the overall health of each economic region, they paint a promising picture. We're seeing evidence of a pretty broad-based recovery. And the one region that hasn't yet turned green in our color scheme is the emerging markets. But as you can see with the numbers, we think that trajectory is very optimistic, and we think that's going to actually turn green pretty soon. Just want to, again, go back to Chris's work. He made a very compelling case for European equities, and we fully agree with this. His mean reversion hypothesis. We think Europe is very well positioned. And one thing we think does not get the attention that it deserves is that consensus earnings, these are FactSet numbers, estimates for the next few years suggest that European growth, European earnings will actually outpace U.S. earnings. And yet, we're at one of the biggest discounts in Europe, European equities versus the U.S. that we've seen in the last decade. That's one of the reasons that we're so excited about Europe. Another point we want to highlight is that the U.S. Dividend payers are especially well positioned. Not only are payout ratios low relative, in that previous chart you could see payout ratios in the 36-37% rate versus over 50% for Europe, and we think earnings are going to grow and dividends will grow. We're also at the point in the Fed rate hike cycle where historically dividend payers really outperform non-dividend payers. So we've looked at 62-63 years of data from French, of FAMA and French fame, of all listed U.S. Stocks with history on dividends. And we looked at the performance of these dividend and non-dividend payers 12 months prior to the first rate hike of each cycle, the past 13 rate hike cycles that are identifiable, and carry that over for the next 2 years after that first rate hike. And what we found is that dividend payers underperform leading into that first rate hike a few months after, but then they start to outperform, and overall they start to really outperform. We are 16, 17 months into this current rate hike cycle, and history suggests, and this is pretty good history, we think, that dividend payers will outpace non-dividend payers in the U.S. Let me just pass it back to Patrick for closing remarks.
So, again, the reason we came together today is we're seeing real investor demand looking for income, total return, as well as global active management. We hope today we've been able to deliver that, explain that to you in these two funds, that both the Alpine Global Dynamic Dividend and the Alpine Total Dynamic Dividend deliver attractive income at a nice discount, total return, as well as active management. With that, I'd like to open up to some questions. Yes. Right here in the front.
It seems though the discount on the fund is historically quite high. The average around 14%. Do you have any thoughts on why that is the case?
The question was the discount on the fund historically is high, and why is that the case? I'll take a stab at that, and then if you guys have any questions. When we went through a lot of the changes in the portfolio, I think the market in many ways was waiting to see how our portfolio management team has done. The yield did drop slightly in 2013. As time has gone on and we've raised that dividend slightly, but more importantly been able to deliver good risk-adjusted results, that has slightly narrowed. So we hope and anticipate that discount will narrow going forward. Yes. So the question was, what are we doing to narrow that discount? Generally speaking, we're doing a lot of the portfolio management, trying to drive the NAV up while delivering that attractive income. But we're not doing anything else outside of that.
But we have done buybacks in the past as well.
Yeah, there have been buybacks. The owners of the firm have done selective buybacks over the last 5 years on the fund.
And communication
Sure. So we have a website where you get all the information updated monthly on these funds. We also do podcasts and written commentaries on the portfolios, trying to communicate frequently with current buyers of the fund and prospects. And we do have a sales team that's available to answer any questions to investor professionals looking to get an update on the funds.
You're not doing anything to draw and pick the buy. I mean, the only way it goes up to NTA is getting more buyers, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's why we're here today.
but we do think that the increased performance of the fund should help, and we are increasing communications. We're doing more podcasts than we've done in the past and more write-ups, so we hope that will help. Yes.
Question. One more?
Well, the trading costs are embedded in our returns. So the returns that you see are net after all trading costs. And our turnover has, since Brian and I took over, have gone down quite a bit. So that reduced the trading costs, which obviously helps the total return as well. You don't have the slide. We could go through the sectors. So certainly our biggest overweight is financials, as you mentioned, our second largest sector right now is industrials. But we do have that all listed on the website.
One thing I would add is you mentioned just sort of the general trends of financials benefiting from rising interest rates. What we try to do with every stock in our portfolio is we're trying to find companies that have the ability and the willingness and the stated desire to raise dividends over time. And that generally means good businesses with above average growth, good balance sheets, good cash generation, and in the case of financials, companies that are exposed right now, we are exposed more towards those that will benefit from rising rates.
Great, thank you.